Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where the evolution takes us. Well, at a recent comedy show, somebody asked the Swami, when will we have peace in the Middle East? And the Swami said, well, first, we must have peace in the Middle West. Because, you know, in some ways, it feels like the political polarities in our society are as opposing and entrenched as those in the Middle East. Well, our guest today is going to offer some encouraging news as well as tested ideas and processes for what he calls engaging the other. This is where we find a connection in our hearts that is greater than the separating beliefs in our heads. You know, our spiritual guides have been talking for millennia about the illusion of separation. So how do we activate and make real the truth of oneness? Today's guest, Steve Olwein, is a therapist with a graduate degree in clinical psychology from Western Michigan University. He has over 35 years experience in community-based mental health. And in the early 1990s, he founded the Common Bond Institute to promote, quote, social healing and conflict transformation, unquote. Common Bond is sponsoring an upcoming conference in April, Engaging the Other, the Power of Compassion. You know, in times of distrust and hatred, even, between sides, engaging the other is designed to create, quote, a shared space to promote deep listening, mutual understandings, appreciation, support, and concerted cooperation. To tap our shared wisdom, compassion, and responsibility in developing practical strategies, and to create immediate opportunities for collaborative action following the conference, unquote. Well, this sounds like a formidable mission, and given our current situation, the timing couldn't be better. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Okay. Well, we'll jump right in. Engaging the other. Why this and why now?
Well, I've always liked the word engaging, and especially in the work that we're doing, it just always seemed to be the best description of what we're trying to accomplish. Because it's, to me, it's not just meeting, and it's not just tolerating or coexisting with any one person or group that we consider the other. It's really about connecting. It's about connecting with those that we assume are the other, and it sort of allows us to have a chance to get in someone else's shoes, to see the world from each other's eyes and from each other's experiences, and that gives us this chance. It gives us an understanding of those kinds of visions and beliefs, regardless of whether we even share them or agree with them, but an understanding of them. And that lets us track back to the fundamental needs and the basic intentions that are behind you, however we are acting. Finding those intentions and finding those basic human needs are things that we can agree on, and then we can see that we have those in common. So that's why we chose the idea of engaging, and engaging the other is because, you know, the other is in many ways how we define ourselves. We always consider ourselves in relation to someone or something else, and the kind of common term that we use often is the other. And it's really a neutral concept. It's not negative, it's not positive, until we decide to give it some type of a quality. So anyway, when we get to that point, when we get to the point where we can agree on and see some common needs and basic intentions, then it's really a matter of paying attention to maybe our different ways of trying to meet those needs and express those common intentions. That's often where we get off track, because we begin to assume that the ways are actually the intentions, and that isn't the case. As a therapist, I see that all the time, and have seen that in working with individuals. When we're doing our larger sort of social healing work in the world, we really see that that also holds true when we're talking about us as a collective, as humanity. And it's a lot easier to see our way to working together and doing that hand in hand when we might disagree on the route to a need or an intention than if we believe that we don't share needs and intentions. It's sort of like, you know, if you and I were in a car and we were going on a road trip, and I'm thinking I want to go to San Francisco and you're thinking you want to go to New York. If that's really the case and each of us believes that, then we're really not going to agree even on a compromise route to get to either place. We're going to be in conflict with that. We're going to oppose each other. I mean, we might try and push each other into the back seat or out of the car just to take control, because we're thinking we're going in opposite directions. And that is sort of a trance state that we put ourselves into. That's a misunderstanding about the basic premise of us as human beings, and that we all really fundamentally have good needs. And we have good intentions about trying to meet those needs. It can get way off track. We can have a great difficulty in seeing how we're trying to get to one place from A to B in terms of each other's perspective. But if we focus on the route, we have a much better chance of accomplishing some type of resolution and coming together.
So if we imagine that we really do, we all do want, like, for example, we want to have a country that serves the needs of the people, that allows us to prosper and thrive. And there are some people who believe the way to do that is hardly any government intervention. And there are those who believe that the way to do that is through intensive government intervention. So how do you, understanding, of course, that we do really all want most of the same things for our world and for our children and for our lives, but we have situations. I mean, certainly, the holiday season the last couple of years has really borne this out, where people who are family members who love one another don't like one another because of these seemingly entrenched political disagreements. So, how do you get to that point where you agree, yes, we all want a world that works, but your way of getting there is to drive to San Francisco, and my way is to drive to New York?
Well, in that analogy, that was an example of believing that we're going in different directions on purpose, that we're actually having different intentions and different needs and goals, when actually the reality is that we're actually on the right path. We're actually in the right stream of trying to accomplish the same things. We're just on different tracks to be able to do that. And I guess the first thing that I would look at, if I'm sitting down with someone who I perceive as having very different ideas about the route that they want to take, is to sort of pay attention to the space we're in. Because if we're in a space where we feel tension and some opposition to each other, we're not really going to let our stomach sort of settle. We're not going to really listen. We're going to simply prepare for presenting our side of the argument. And so a lot of what we try to do in a conference is we really pay attention to setting the stage and creating a safe and honoring and respectable space where people aren't expected to change their minds even. They're just invited to come in with their ears first, and then to be able to share from that deep sense of what their real purpose is, what their real intentions are. And then we can, once we get past that, then we can begin to talk more about your particular way of accomplishing the same need and my particular way of accomplishing that. So when you're talking about families, first of all, it's difficult because there are all kinds of things at stake when you sit down with someone who you have a long-term loving relationship with and you have these stark disagreements. But often, it's first starting with being able to listen and expecting that the person has a good intention behind whatever route that they're deciding to take.
And I think that you really made a good point about setting the stage so that you make it easier for people to be vulnerable. There's no resistance. You know, you're not preparing your side of the argument while the other person is talking, but because of the ground rules of what you're doing, you're creating ground rules for engagement, for listening to people, and listening to be heard, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll get back to that in a little bit. I want to talk to you a little bit about how you particularly found this calling, how you got started with this. You were a therapist, and what caused you to help found the Common Boundaries Institute?
Well, you mentioned that I'm a therapist, and even before then, in my university years, like a lot of people during that time in your life, I was involved in a lot of peace and civil rights movement activities at that time, and so it increased my sensitivity to the underlying issues around social consciousness and social well-being that that everyone has a right to, and what are the challenges and barriers that are preventing individuals or groups from achieving that. After I got my degree, I worked for a number of years in community mental health, and I worked really primarily in minority and underserved communities. I did a lot of outreach, a lot of advocacy work. And that was really my passion and my love in the work. And then over the same time, my professional and philosophical home was with the Association for Humanistic Psychology, which actually, Steve, I think that's where we first met at some of the AHP conferences. And then,
oh, yes, of course, yeah.
Yeah. And then in 19...
Indianapolis, probably. The one in Indianapolis.
Somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Then back in, it was in 1990 that I started to coordinate AHP's Soviet American Professional Exchange. I did that for 15 years. And during that time, I was also on the board. And most of my focus, really, as a board member, was on our international relationships and reaching out, just trying to make contact, at that point, primarily with our Soviet colleagues. And around the same time, actually, I think it was the same year, I started working with providing cultural competency training to Western therapists who were heading off to Kuwait. This was right after, at the end of the Iraqi invasion, when the Iraqi troops left. And there was just a great need for trauma therapists in a country that really had no tradition for that kind of mental health service. After maybe 2 or 3 years of my working with the professional exchange, I had some colleagues come and spend an entire summer here from Russia and from Lithuania. And following that, we decided to start a conference. It was initially going to be a seminar, and it grew from a half-day seminar to a six-day conference, and it became the annual international conference on conflict resolution. We did that in St. Petersburg and held that for 16 years, actually. And what we would do is we'd bring people, not only from the U.S. and from Russia and from Europe, but we could bring people from regions of conflict and even war from around the world. And we would, they were very intense experiences. We'd get 6 days in a Russian hotel out in the middle of nowhere. And then we would hold a number of them over for a week or two and give them some intensive training in crisis intervention and trauma relief skills that they could take back home with them, because all of them came from traumatized communities. And that led us, over the years, to developing these ongoing programs that we've been involved with ever since. We've operated our local capacity building training and treatment programs in Russia. We've done it in the Balkans and the Caucasus. And now our primary focus is in the Middle East. And that's where we've been really focused on running field clinics and service programs for Syrian refugees and training local people in these kinds of psychosocial skills so that they can then gradually take over this kind of service right in their own home community.
I was going to say that you said that in Iraq, they just didn't have this kind of service at all. I mean, people just kind of thought, I would suppose, you're used to being traumatized and there's no way for healing it. So how do these populations who are not familiar with these particular humanistic psychology techniques and so on, how do they take it on and respond and then embody it themselves?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the beginning of our work, there was a lot of resistance to the idea of mental health. There's There were a lot of stigmas attached to it. A lot of people did not want to step forward to say that they needed services. And often the kind of local services that were present were in name only. It's sort of like if you take on the name of a service and you say, I'm doing psychosocial service, but the people who are doing it are not trained in that. So they're really working intuitively at best. And so in the beginning, it was difficult. We had to come in a very sensitive way. We changed much of the terminology. We never called it therapy or mental health or psychiatric or psychological. The name of our program, for example, is social health care. And we presented it as building sort of like personal strength and resilience to be able to overcome challenges in life. Personal development, self-help skills, those kinds of things, which people could resonate with. And because we called it social health, they equated it with medical health, which people were much more receptive to. But you know,
it's funny.
What I could say was interesting is that over the years, people have jumped over the stigma. Now you have people stepping forward and asking for mental health services because they're in such dire straits. The trauma is so deep and so pervasive in this, particularly the community we're working with, that people have just decided, I mean, there's no room for, the resistance in terms of the labels and the stigma. People feel the immediate need. They also see people getting better who receive it, in their family, in their community. So now there's very little resistance to that.
Yeah, we're going to be taking a short break in a little while, in a short minute. And then when we come back from the break, let's talk a little bit about bringing this back home, why you've brought Engaging the Other back to the United States. We'll be back after a couple of minutes after this break and commercial spots.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma, and wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Mm-hmm. Hi there, Steve Behrman. We're back on WikiPolitiki with our guest, Steve Olwin, talking about engaging the other. And we're just about to talk about that. You did talk about programs that you've done in the Middle East. And so now we're bringing it back to the Middle West. I remember being at a conference in San Mateo, California, that you did maybe 8 years ago. And then I understand that you've really been mostly working overseas, and now you have a conference here. So why'd you bring it back home now?
Well, I can tell you that we've missed working here in the U.S. We did a series of conferences pretty much during the same years we've been working outside the country. But we have been more absent in terms of stateside kinds of activities for several years now. And what was happening was we started to be approached maybe actually a bit over a year ago by individuals who knew of our work and some organizations and Edgewood College in Madison, Michigan State University, just to ask if we were interested in revitalizing the Engage in the Other conferences. And there, what they kept pointing to was this rising toxic division and polarity here in the United States and great concerns about where that was leading. And so because we essentially focus in the Middle East because we're a web-based volunteer primarily organization, and we just didn't have the kind of bandwidth in terms of our time and energy to do a lot in the United States and the Middle East. But because Edgewood came and offered us the site and the site logistics, and both they and Michigan State University offered organizational support, we decided to do it. And that's something I'm very concerned about as well in terms of what's been happening here in the U.S. and I've been paying, certainly since the election, paying more and more attention to.
Mm-hmm. Now, having participated in this conference earlier, I'm curious as to what is it that's most emerged for you from these past events? What were your biggest learning experiences and your biggest, I would say, successes?
Well, I think our biggest successes have been in developing what I mentioned before in terms of creating a safe space. We've always been rather amazed at how if you do a good job of that, how people begin to lead with their best intentions. And they begin to feel an urgency, actually, to reach out when they realize that they've been operating under really misunderstandings of others, broad brushing entire groups of people without really getting to know them on a human and a personal level. And so the biggest accomplishment, I would say, is doing a good job of, in fact, an image that we try to use is the idea of creating a mandala. And if we do a very good job of creating that center that has some specifics that people can relate to from the beginning, but also leaves many openings for people who come to our conferences to complete the mandala themselves, then we find that people do that. And there have been a number of very practical programs that have come out of our conferences, some that we're involved in, some that other people just meet at the conferences and go off on their own and form. And so in that sense, feeding a lot of good work that comes out of the conferences. We use the conferences to bring people together, to address very critical issues, to allow people that transformative kind of experience. And then we always have action planning on the final day where people can begin to put some specifics into place in terms of what they will do starting Monday morning, for example. And that's what we're hoping to do here. We're also hoping to always be part of a consistent stream. We're not really, we're very collaborative. That's always been our character. We're not really interested in trying to be it or being the primary and the most effective kind of organization or effort. We're really interested more in being within a stream of efforts. There are many going on, which you're aware of here in the United States, for example. And so what we want to do is we want to be a collaborative and contributing part of that, sort of an essential part of a puzzle. And if we can meet that essential part and provide something that maybe isn't there or isn't there enough, then as a whole, as a synergistic whole, really, then we can really accomplish much more together. Because I look at this new the model that we are following of collaboration, which I think really is the new model, the necessary paradigm that we need to be in order to address a lot of the really large and pervasive and even global challenges that we face as a human community. If anyone or organization tries to do it alone and takes on that separateness that sometimes is organizational and ego-oriented, then even if they're the largest organization, even if they sort of win the Academy Award of organizations that are addressing deep and critical social needs, they will always fail because it's impossible for any one entity or group or system to handle all of what we need to take care of in the world today. So the collaboration is another thing that, and that modeling that, being part of that and promoting that is a big part of what we shoot for with our conferences and all of our training.
I really like the mandala metaphor because the circle is very democratic. Everybody is equal around the circle. It's non-hierarchical. And obviously from this hub in the center, these collaborations can spring out that are totally unplanned, except that they're intentional by the intention of the conference. Could you give us an example of some of the, or of a project or projects or collaborations that have sprung from this kind of conference and this kind of engagement?
Well, as far as the engaging the other conference here in the U.S., back in 2012, actually it was the end of 2011 and then into 2012, one example is that a number of people who came from along the social political spectrum here in the United States and who were part of that conference came together and we formed a virtual national dialogue that we operated about every 2 weeks. We did that for several months. And as that continued, or as it progressed, we began to bring in more people. At one point, we were over 20 people who were on that call. That got to be a real logistical management issue. But the main thing that I saw happening that was really very affirming to me and really amazing to watch was that people naturally began talking about what can we do together, not to change each other's minds, not to shift from left to right or whatever, but simply to address the polarization and the toxic nature of the divides that began to paint each other as not just opposed to each other, but in a sense carrying a sort of an evil characteristic or nature. And so we talked about things like forming joint events together, inviting each other to each other's partisan meetings and community gatherings, developing joint op-eds, coming out with joint resolutions addressing the polarity. Actually, after one of our conferences, Joan Blades and Max Pappas, Joan with with her roots in MoveOn.org, and Max at the time with his roots in FreedomWorks, that were sort of the counterparts to each other, they did come out with an op-ed addressing polarization. And I think that happened not because we directed it or even conceived of it in advance at all, but it just sort of organically came together. And unfortunately, 2012 was a contentious national election. A lot of people who were very politically involved began getting pressure from their counterpart communities, asking questions like, why are you engaging with the other side? You should be opposing them. You shouldn't be engaging in collaborative kind of discussions. And so we decided to put it on hold just to relieve the heat, in a sense, and let people get past that time of pressure. It was also, unfortunately, when my time was being shifted dramatically away from involvement here in the U.S. and more toward the Middle East. And unfortunately, after the election, we didn't come back together again. And I think it was a lost opportunity, but it was mostly an example of what can happen and that what we hope. And actually, myself, I expect these kinds of things to happen because I've seen it happen time and time again over the almost three decades now that we've been doing this work. Our work in the Middle East, the work we've done in the Caucasus and in the Balkans in terms of equipping local communities with not only trauma healing skills, but also some basic civil society skills, how to resolve conflict, how to use nonviolent communication in addressing issues and working together. We've done that for years, and we've seen people take those skills and use them, attaching to their own good intentions, and really use them very effectively. So those are examples of concrete application of the kind of energy and the kind of awarenesses and insights and transformations that would happen at our conferences.
Yeah, my sense is that right now the time is ripe for this kind of gathering together. I just got back from the Represent Us conference, Unrig the System Summit. People from all across the political spectrum coming together to develop standards to hold our governance to that reflect these common values that we have. And Joan Blades has gone on to create something called Living Room Conversations, which take that idea of engaging the other by inviting people that you know and having them invite people they know who are from different political perspectives, and coming together in a living room, a neutral space, a space of socializing, and these have been very successful.
Joan is part of our advisory group, as you are.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I seem to remember that. And so what I'm noticing now is that these kinds of things have been going on for years. And you had that back in the 80s and 90s, before the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was so much hope and anticipation about what would happen if the wall fell and the kinds of engagement that would occur between the two states. And so here we are, approximately nearly 30 years after, and in this 30-year period, we've managed to retrench the Cold War. So I'm just wondering if you have any perspective on that, and why was there apparently this movement forward that turned into a movement backward?
Well, I think, Steve, there are different stratums to pay attention to in terms of what's going on in the world around our global relations. One of them, obviously, is at that higher political governmental level. And who knows what the motivations and intentions are. I think they're myriad and conflicting by nature. And so there's always that juxtapositioning and maneuvering that's going on. And missed calls. I think we missed a call when Russia really opened up to the West, and they were not necessarily met with a lot of support and help. Germany, for example, did something amazing when Russia was on the brink of falling over a cliff economically. They just packed train loads of food and medical supplies and clothing and so on, and they just shipped it into Russia. They just sent massive amounts of aid into Russia. Unfortunately, our government here in the United States took more of a wait-and-see attitude, sitting back and questioning whether it was a real transformation or change within the Soviet system to a non-Soviet system. But we lost a lot of goodwill. I can tell you at the time we were going through Russia, and there was a lot of expectation that if people just did what they did, went to the streets, had civil disobedience, not violent disobedience, but nonviolent resistance, that just said we're not going to cooperate with the system anymore. And the system fell. I mean, like dominoes, it fell. But then what happened was the same people who took those risks suddenly experienced their lifestyle dropping dramatically, their security dropping dramatically, and the outside world, in many ways, especially the leaders governmentally, were either biding their time or they were doing minimal kinds of things. And we lost that goodwill, unfortunately. Now you have someone like Putin who comes in, points to that, and says you can't rely on the West or the U.S. or the rest of the world. They want to see us fail, and you need a strong man, in a sense, to sort of pull us up from our bootstraps. But I can say
sounds like what Americans have been saying.
Yeah.
Sounds like the retrenchment of America, too.
Yeah. But I can say that on another level, when you look at how many groups and individuals and organizations there are in the world that are working toward reconciliation, social healing, improving relations, creating passionate relationships with each other, it is phenomenal how many there are. It's one of the most massively growing phenomenons in the world right now. Our learning curve, we're in it 24/7. Our learning curve is always learning about new ones that we didn't know about before. And I'm very, very encouraged by that. I mean, it's I think one of the best kept secrets. We hear a lot about the negative stuff. We hear a lot about a particular country's government not getting along with a particular country's government. But we don't hear about what's happening at more of the track two and track three and grassroots level. I mean, we've had people from Iran come to our conferences in Russia, really wonderful people who came, and then unfortunately when we tried to develop some cooperation, they ran into problems with their government, and we ran into problems with our government. I mean, I remember I was invited to the, I can't think of the name of the office right now, the second sort of in command assistant to the ambassador of the country for the U.S. ambassador to Russia, asked me to come for a luncheon meeting one time because we had an Iranian at our conference. And the first question he asked me on the phone, he said, I have to ask you this question because I have to be known that I asked you this question. Is this person a terrorist? And I chuckled and I said, well, he's coming to a peace conference, so I assume he's coming here with good intentions, so I don't think he's a terrorist. And that person actually asked me to bring, his name was Mohammed Tarani, and he asked me to bring him to his office. And we had lunch together, and it was a great meeting, a great time of being together. But that person also said, I think it's Consul General, that was his title. He also said, you know, I don't know if I can do this again. I'm doing it now because it's sort of under the understanding that I'm checking things out. I wish I could do this again, but I can't promise that I can do this again. And it never happened again, you know, also. So at that level, to be honest, I don't hold a lot of hope at that level. I think that there's a real crisis of leadership at that higher level, but there is not a crisis of leadership at where it really counts, where I think the real changes are happening, can happen, and that's at the grassroots level. And that's where people who are willing to collaborate and be part of a larger effort really can, that's where I think the shift in the world can happen.
We're going to talk more about that after this short break. And we'll be back with Steve Olwin, Engaging the Other, on WikiPolitiki Radio.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the WikiPolitiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toast from a shelter in 2011. I love Toast because she's a lazy diva. Toast does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman back with Steve Olwin talking about engaging the other. You know, as you were talking about the differences between how individuals engage from the heart and the kind of entanglements that happen when They try to do it through official means and where the governments have been at. It reminds me of that famous quote by Dwight Eisenhower from 60-something years ago. And the gist of the quote is that the day is going to come when the people of the world want peace so badly that their governments will have to give it to them. And I think we may be on the cusp of one of these, moments where there is such an uprising, where people are waking up and wising up to what you've been talking about this entire hour, which is the fundamental connection that we have with one another at the heart, and how that particular connection leads us into this next paradigm. So pick that up a little bit, and you know, what are some of the things that you see that are signs of the uprising, that are signs that this is all moving in the right direction?
Well, you know, one of the things that I pay a lot of attention to is our ability to connect with pretty much anyone in the world that you want to on any given day. I think the internet is this amazing anthropologically historic, just this amazing process and an opportunity for us to connect with people. I mean, I connect with somebody in the backlands of Australia. I can connect with someone in New York. I can connect with someone in Antarctica if I want. And it's direct. You can see someone now on the screen. You can talk to each other as if they're on the other side of a window. I think that's very empowering. And I pay a lot of attention to who is trying to control that and place screens and filters in between that. I'm always amazed at how whenever a filter is sort of imposed, someone in the world finds a way around it. And then people sort of catch on and they share it, they learn about it, and then pretty soon people are using the workaround. So I have a lot of faith in the wisdom and the skills and the creativity of people in general to want that kind of a connection. So I think social media, I think just whatever comes through with connecting to the internet is something we really have not even seen the possibilities of yet. I mean, it's never happened in our human history that we can have that level of direct, unfiltered contact with another human being, especially someone who lives in a community that we feel like we have no knowledge of, we have no contact with. Maybe we have stereotypical images of, and here we're able to sit and talk with the person. And with the language translation possibilities, we can even skip past that barrier. And I think that's going to improve even more and more as time goes on. So that's very exciting to me. We actually try to bring that in as much as possible to our conferences, even in our practical programs, in our trainings that we do, in our service that we provide. We literally go to Jordan and we provide those services, and in between we run live virtual trainings, and we run telemental health services. Allows us to reach areas that we never could go into. I mean, for a while we were working with UNHCR's office in Damascus. There's no way we could go to Damascus. But what we could do is we could come in on the phone, we could come in on Skype, and we could provide them with guidance and consultations. We were going to set up a training program, actually, in teaching those staff how to do crisis intervention phone line work, basically phone and Skype work, because many of the people in Syria weren't able to be reached by them either, and they were continually being contacted in various ways asking for help. But unfortunately, that got tied up in the bureaucracy of the UN, and that particular thing didn't happen. But it could happen, and it is happening. We're able to connect with groups in Iraq. We're able to move into areas that we physically can't go into, and we will do more so as time goes on through this virtual means. So I guess, in a nutshell, that vehicle of connection and communication that is increasingly available to us and that has not been available to this extent in human history is really something that I think holds a great deal of promise.
You know, there's two recent conversations I've had. One is on last week's show with Richard Lang, who's developed something called National Town Square. And the other is with a colleague of mine, Timothy Nobles, who is writing a book called More Than Enough, which is really about how we really do have more than enough. And what's required is that we simply activate the connections between us so that we stop spending so much of our energy feeding conflict and defending positions, and we can begin to collaborate. And Timothy's thesis that he just talked to me yesterday about, as a matter of fact. His thesis is that in the past, one could argue that we've needed these hierarchical systems in order to organize our activities, in order to function. And now, because everybody, and I mean everybody, people who lived in thatched huts have cell phones. Everybody almost has access to this universal web of communication. And so in a way, it makes these top-down forms unnecessary. And part of this upwising that you are a part of is helping people wake up to these new possibilities and how they're much, much more efficient and effective than what we've been doing. So why don't you tell us more about this conference that's coming up in April, and give us some information about that. Who might want to attend? When is it? And we'll take it from there.
Well, the conference is held April the 13th to the 15th. It's in Madison, Wisconsin. It's at Edgewood College. If folks go to our website, then they can get a lot of the details for that. That website URL is CBI, for Common Bond Institute, so it's cbiworld.org. And you'll see other pieces of information about the other work that we're engaged in, but that conference is listed there. You go to that section, and it gives you a lot of those sort of logistical details. As far as what people could be doing, I think that, first of all, they can come to the conference. And if they can't come to the conference, then we'll have some virtual elements to it that they can tune into. We plan to do on-site blogging and posting of summaries every night. We're looking at hopefully developing some live connections so that we can broadcast out some live proceedings, and then people can simply go to our website and have access to what's going on. That's one way of getting involved. If somebody wants to actually volunteer, we're always open to volunteers who would like to help us with the operations. That's another thing I wanted to mention, is that something that we always promote is the involvement of students and young adults. And that's also something that I'm the most encouraged about, is really the amount of involvement that I'm just experiencing and aware of young people stepping forward and doing really amazing and innovative kinds of things. So young folks coming, and we always involve them in everything from design to organizing the conference, operating it, practical applications afterward, and so on, and processes within the conference, like facilitation and so on. The other is, is basically to have representation at the conference for existing initiatives, because what we want to do is we're inviting participation of people who are looking for something to get involved in. They may not know in particular how to follow through with their urging or their wishing to do something, and so we're promoting that and letting people know that if you come to the conference, you will meet people who are representing a lot of wonderful initiatives around the country focused on the same issues and the same purpose, and you'll be able to talk with them directly and see what the opportunities are to get involved. That's something that we're looking forward to really promoting along the way. And I guess another thing that we're doing that is important actually to point out is we're looking for organizations that are doing like-purposed events that we can link with. We're aware of some that literally are happening within a week of ours before and immediately afterwards. One of them is the one that Pierce Godwin and others are involved in out in North Carolina, that we're hoping to do some promotion of their event to encourage people to go to that, but also to see if we may have some links between what comes out of our conference, what emerges there that might sort of move into that conference, and they could take it a step further. And then, and the idea is to sort of keep that process going. What could come after that event and after the next event that could create that stream I'm talking about, that really could create more of a critical mass of efforts and involvement, both from people who physically go to these things and people who become aware of them and people who connect to the virtual mechanism and so on, and really feel that citizen diplomacy in the United States, you know, between us as a society, that everybody can get involved in and feel like they're contributing to it.
You know, I think part of what you're talking about is the ends and the means are one and the same. So if you're helping people collaborate, you have a collaborative attitude. And, you know, we've seen that in many ways, Paul Hawken in his book, Blessed Unrest, talks about 250,000 different well-meaning nonprofit organizations. And not to pan any of that, but in a certain regard, they're like 250,000 single-cell organisms that are, in a way, struggling over the food when evolution requires collaboration and connection. Evolution requires an increase in connection between the individual cells, so to speak, and also shared awareness and shared information. So the idea that you are not seeing yourself in competition with the conference in North Carolina, but you're looking for ways that you all could collaborate around the same intention. So I think that in itself is an evolutionary step that, you know, and if we take that step, then I think we'll really greatly improve our effectiveness and the value of our work.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That's probably our largest obstacle in our work is when we're faced with a lack of collaboration and mutual support. And that, unfortunately, that sense of someone's mission or organization or status or work is being threatened because someone else wants to do something similar and work with, you know, and collaborate, that seem more of a threat than a benefit. So I think we had to really address that as it's sort of a lie we tell ourselves. It's almost like saying there's a finite amount of goodwill that we can have in the world. but it is a belief system, and we face it all the time. One of the things we do is try to be sensitive to that. When we first went into Jordan, there were a lot of grassroots organizations that were paraprofessional at best or less, but they had this niche. They were identifying themselves as like the locally based psychosocial services. And when we first began offering training and to come in and demonstrate treatment skills, we had a lot of resistance because they saw us wanting to come in and set up a competing system. But when they began to realize over maybe a couple of years that we were coming in to bolster the local players, not to replace them or compete with them, and that we were offering free services, training, to increase their capability so they could actually do more and do better, it's completely switched. Now we're approached all the time by local NGOs and universities. We just started with three of the medical schools in Jordan, we started a new initiative to train their medical students in psychosocial skills, because they really have there are no internships in Jordan for mental health. Anyone who wants to get a degree and have a professional licensing has to leave the country, go somewhere else to get it. 99% of them never come back because they find a better life. And so there's always this talent drain from Jordan. What we're offering is to provide that. And we partner with Michigan State University's Department of Psychiatry in lending that expertise and that sort of academic muscle to what we're doing as well. But collaboration, you know, it's vital. Once you get in sort of into the habit of that, in the stream of that, and you feel the benefits, then what we find is those players gravitate toward that and are hungry for it. And that's, you know, that's what I see as, I know what you're saying about a lot of the single-cell organisms that are trying to do their own thing, but I think that's changing. I think it's being, and maybe because it's easier to communicate with each other and see each other's work, that is changing, and there are many more opportunities for partnership. I'm finding that just in terms of us putting together this next ETO conference. This is the eighth one we've done, but it's been a few years, so I'm learning about what's been going on in the meantime, and I'm amazed at how many collaborative efforts there are in the country, and that's why we're really eager to get connected with that that pool of organizations and groups and people that are doing this kind of work.
You know, what's really very interesting is that it just occurs to me that the work that's been going on for 35 years or longer is cumulative, and that once people have been exposed to this, it doesn't go away. Even if they return to their community and their people go, why did you associate with those people? Nonetheless, I think that more and more and more, the reason why perhaps people are more inclined to collaborate is because people are seeing that this is the wave of the future. It's more and more and more becoming the wave of the future. Well, we're getting very, very close to the end of our time together. That was a very quick hour with Steve Olwin and Engaging the Other. If you want to find out more about the conference, go to CBI, as Common Boundary Institute World, cbiworld.org. Common Bond, I'm sorry. Common Bond Institute. I'm sorry, I didn't. I guess I bounded the boundary or bounded the boundary.
Yeah,
or something
there is a
like
common
that.
Boundary, too.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. Okay, so it's cbiworld.org /conferences/ETO, and you'll be able to find out more about that. We also have a link on the WikiPolitiki website for this. And I'm wishing you the best with this conference. Any final words? We probably have about a minute or less before the music starts. Oh, I said it.
Collaboration. Collaboration. I'll throw that out again. I can never say that.
That's a good word. Thank you, Steve Olwin. Engaging the Other. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki.